Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, consult other tax professionals, and teach tax seminars around the country. She's been with us a long time and does a wonderful job. You have a question about filing your taxes, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
April 15th is the deadline for filing taxes. But if you need more time to file, how do you file an extension?
There is an extension form, and depending on whether you do it electronically, there is a 4810 form, which is an electronic filing form it is an extension form that you need to file with the government. You fill it out, you estimate what your taxes are. If you owe taxes, it's advisable to send an extension payment with it so that you don't pay interest or penalty for not paying timely. Once you send that in, then you have, depending on what kind of return you have, generally it's a six-month extension that you get, and by October 15th, everything has to be taken care of.
The penalties, last year I underpaid my taxes, and so I paid a penalty. This year I was smarter. In 2023 I screwed up. So in 2024 I sent in some extra tax money and wound up actually getting a small rebate. But the penalties, how does the IRS issue their penalties?
Well, there is an underpayment penalty and an interest penalty. And before we get into that, the number of the return is a 4868, not the 4810 that I mentioned. 4868 is the federal extension number for individuals. And all of your tax is due by April 15th. If you don't pay the tax by April 15th, the IRS will charge interest on any underpayment that you have, but they will also assign either a failure to pay, or if you didn't bother to file an extension, there is a failure to file penalty. The failure to pay penalty is 0.5% per month. The failure to file penalty is a 5% penalty per month, maximum of 25%. So filing an extension is a very important thing if you're going to owe money. If you have a refund coming, they're not quite as concerned with it.
Mm-hmm. They're not going to pay any interest on the overpayment.
No, they're not going to. If you file late, it's on your dime. If they're the reason the refund is held up, then yes, they do pay interest. And the interest rate, I believe it's 7%. They may have dropped it to 6%, but it's in that range. Every quarter, the IRS or the government comes out with the appropriate interest rates, and we've been on the downturn. But not anywhere compared to what they were a few years ago. They were much lower. So you're borrowing by not paying your taxes. Technically, you're borrowing money from the government, and you will pay interest for it. One other thing I want to say about the extensions. If you file the 4868 extension, it will automatically extend your federal and your state return. If you've already filed the federal and for some reason haven't filed the state, then you need to get a state extension. But otherwise, one federal extension will cover both returns. And the state also charges you for being late. They don't charge an underpayment penalty, but the interest rate charged by the state of Wisconsin is 12%, unless you're really, really late and it goes up to 18%. So you don't really want to be late with them.
No, you don't. Well, Charlie in Chippewa Falls has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning. Hey, we have on a couple occasions received a 1042-S form from our bank, and we're kind of wondering why.
Well, that's a very good question, Charlie. My first question would be, are you a U.S. citizen?
Yes.
Typically, a 1042-S form has to do with a foreign person earning U.S. money. So I'm not sure if you're a U.S. citizen why they're sending you a 1042-S. I would be asking the bank about that. But it's typically if a foreign person works in the U.S. or has investments in the U.S., the 1042-S is typically the form that the foreign person would receive regarding the U.S. income.
Got it. So check with your bank, Charlie. Thank you for calling. Irene in Phillips has a question. Hi, Irene. Irene, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
I file taxes for my son. Oh, yes. Can you? Okay. Yep. I file taxes for my son. And he sold a piece of land in Wisconsin here. And I received a copy B of 1099-S, proceeds from a real estate transaction. I've never seen this before. What forms should I use? And are the instructions in the books that I have?
Well, there are always instructions for forms. The 1099-S is just the document that the seller or the person that's closing the sale uses to identify the sale and notify the IRS of that sale. So a 1099-S is similar to a 1099-B that you would get for a brokerage sale. It's just it happens to deal with real estate. The sale of real estate generally is a capital asset, and generally it's sold on a Schedule D or 8949 is the first place that it goes. If it was involved with a business, for instance, farm, then it would go on a Form 4797. Again, you'll find under the sale of a capital asset or the sale of a business asset, either of those two forms you'll find instructions. You need to know what the sales price is. You need to know what the cost basis or investment, if you will, in that land was. And the difference between the two is the taxable event.
Irene, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Bill in Oregon. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry, Mary. I'm the sole member of a Wisconsin LLC that has elected to be treated as an S-Corp. Now, let's say that the pass-through entity has ordinary business income of $1,000 on my Schedule K-1, which is taxed on my personal return. My question is, what is the correct way to record the transfer of that $1,000 from the S-Corp to me, its sole member?
What you're talking about is a distribution of the $1,000. And on the K-1, there is a line number on the right-hand side. I don't remember the box number exactly. It could be 16. It could be 20. That records the distribution. You report the $1,000 of income, end of discussion. That $1,000 becomes part of your cost basis, which in an S corporation, you're required to track that basis. The $1,000 does not show up on the tax, the distribution does not show up on the tax return. That gets subtracted from your $1,000 basis, and you have a zero basis in the S-Corp. There is a new form. I believe it's the 7203 form that the IRS requires that you track your basis and include that form with your individual tax return. So the $1,000 will show up in Part E, the Schedule E Part 2 of the tax return. You'll pay taxes on it. The distribution reduces your basis. It's a non-taxable issue as long as you don't take out more than you have basis. Then if you take out more than you have basis, that's a whole nother part of the situation and can cause tax consequences.
There you go, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. And Tony in West Bend, it's your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Mary and Larry. These appearances on Larry's show this season have been really helpful. Thank you so much. I have a couple of questions. How does a filer know if your return was accepted? If the Fed or state cashes your check, is that any kind of acknowledgement that your return was accepted? Or do you sometimes see them come back with questions after checks have been cashed? And then I'm wondering what you're seeing for times from the time you file to people seeing their refund checks this year.
Okay, that's lots of good questions. Number one, if you use a professional and it's electronically filed, we get an acknowledgement back with our electronic filing that, of course, has a date. That tells us that the return is with the IRS or the state of Wisconsin. If you use a personal product, there probably is an acknowledgement. Since I don't use those, I can't tell you whether there is or not. If you send it in the mail, it's a shot in the dark. You hope and pray that it gets there. The next part is cashing the check. If the check was cashed by the IRS, generally there's coding. If you were to look at the back of a check, there would be coding, and that would be able to tell someone who can read that coding who cashed it, when and where it was cashed. It's a good sign if the check has cleared your bank that the IRS has it. But you still can get correspondence, because it's my understanding the checks go to a lockbox and they're automatically cashed. The problems that come in is if the IRS doesn't know whose return it goes to and can't decide, that check, even though the IRS has it, may not have been matched up to your particular return. That doesn't happen real often, but it can. Just an example, in the case of a husband and wife, if the husband dies, the wife files the final return as a joint return, just as if the husband had been there. If the wife sends a check to the IRS, she's not the primary taxpayer. If she would put her Social Security number on, as it asks you to do, the IRS would credit it to her Social Security number, and it might be a mismatch that has to be sorted out, because yes, it's there. Yes, it belongs to that return, only they didn't match it up that way. Again, it doesn't happen real often, but it's one of the things that when you get the notice that says you still owe money, you have to go back and look. First of all, did your check cash through the bank? And second of all, where did it go after that? So a little bit of stuff that can be unraveled and usually can be after time. And as far as getting the refunds out, the IRS has been good this year that refunds have been coming back. If they're electronically filed returns, we kind of like to say 2 weeks generally. If that's the case, it's usually electronic deposit of that is usually done within 2 weeks. Paper checks take longer. All you can do is kind of wait till you get the check. Don't spend it before you get it.
Okay. And Tony, I can tell you that it was about 10 days for me to get my information or my money deposited into my account directly for the feds and about seven for the Wisconsin. So it was pretty darn fast for me, for sure. Our guest today, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals. Great to have her with us. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking taxes today with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her back with us. A couple of emails. Jacob wonders, do you need to file for taxes if you're over 70 and only live on Social Security benefits?
That's a wonderful question. Your filing requirement generally is based on the standard deduction. If you're over 70, your standard deduction is increased. So if you're a single person that's over 65 or over, the filing requirement for federal is $16,550. Now, if Social Security is your only source of income, there is no filing requirement. I mean, there is no filing needed because Social Security only becomes taxable when it fits the formula and you have to have other income to cause it to be taxable.
Now, on the other end of the age spectrum here, Mario has a high school daughter with a part-time job and wonders what's the minimum someone needs to earn before needing to file a 1040?
Again, for a child, if it's earned income, it's $14,600 for this year. If the child who is a dependent has unearned income, generally we're talking about investment income, then the number is lower. And if their investment income is over around $1,400, that's just a round number, they may have to file a return. If they're a dependent, it's what we call kiddie tax, that they could have some income implications then. Also, one other thing for a child or for anyone that matters, if you are self-employed, maybe the child who, you know, has a summer job that mows lawns, but they're an independent contractor, if their income is over $400, they have to file a tax return. Not that they'll necessarily owe income tax, but they may owe self-employment tax. So a variety of things. But the easy answer is most high school kids have a little part-time job, not a lot of interest or investment income, and generally do not have to file a return until it gets over $14,600.
And before we go back to the phones, one other question. If you have your RMD, or required minimum distribution, sent directly to a nonprofit, in other words, you don't handle it, do you still have to claim it as income? It sort of looks that way in the tax form.
Okay. What that is being described is what we call a QCD, or a qualified charitable distribution. If you are age 70 and a half or older, you can transfer money from your IRA up to $100,000 in a year from your IRA to a charity. Basically, the idea is it's giving you a deduction upfront without having to itemize. You still have to file a tax return because you'll get a 1099-R that will look like everybody else who gets an RMD that doesn't do QCDs. You report that what's on the 1099-R, and you do a special adjustment to it to lower it by the amount that you've sent to the charity. A mysterious QCD appears on the tax return in the margin that tells the IRS what's going on.
Got it. Kathy and Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have a question about a long-term capital loss. I sold stock in 2023. I had a loss of over $3,000, about $3,200. So I used that loss, but then I was allowed to carry it over into 24 because my income was only Social Security and it wasn't taxable. So it really didn't help me at all with taxes. I didn't have a tax. So on my capital loss carryover forms for 23, now that I'm working on 24, my federal shows the full amount of 3,200. My state only shows 200. And I'm wondering why there's a discrepancy.
I believe that you have to go through the form on the state. I believe the state will have the same carryover as the federal. It's probably just something that wasn't done correctly. Take a look at the Schedule WD and take a look. I'm not aware that Wisconsin is going to make you lose the carryover as a result of it. They're both two independent calculations. There is the WD form on the state of Wisconsin that you would work through for that. About 2 years ago, Wisconsin got on the same page with federal, and we both have a maximum $3,000 loss. Prior to that, Wisconsin only allows $500, and that did a lot with the carryovers that were different from the federal. But I believe you should have both of them to be the same.
There you go, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. I'm sorry, Kathy. And on now to Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I got married last March, and this year for taxes, we decided to file separately. And so I don't know if it's because of the software that I use or what, but my federal tax was accepted, or my federal form was accepted. But then when it came time to file for state taxes, I was told I couldn't do married file separately because the state is a communal state or a community state. So I was just confused. I don't know if it's because it's the software or if I need to amend my tax return.
Question that I would ask you. Have you and your husband lived together during 2024?
Yes.
Okay. Second question. Did you, when you got married, sign any marital property agreements saying what's mine and what's yours is yours?
No.
Okay. So here's the problem. Wisconsin is a marital property state, otherwise identified as a community property state. The laws, you know, I don't know the legal side of it, but from a tax standpoint, think of the term community property. What that means is from the day you get married, unless you've signed a premarital agreement or have not lived together at all during the year, you are required to split income. If you filled out your tax return with only your income on your tax return and your husband does just his income on his tax return, it's wrong. And that's probably why you're having a problem with Wisconsin, because you have to take whatever income your husband had, split it in two, half goes on your return, half goes on his return. Whatever income you had, half goes on your return, half goes on your husband's return. And that starts the date of marriage. So in your year, you have a little even more confusion because the first part of the year when you weren't married, that income goes on in total. So you will have to amend the tax return if it wasn't done that way and either do a lot of reading. Wisconsin has a marital property publication. I believe the federal has one. There are, I believe, 9 states that are community property states where this situation occurs. Otherwise, search for a tax professional that can help you with it.
Yeah, well, Could they file just a joint return for the state?
You're still, federal abides by state law, so if you live together at all during the year, the federal sees you as a community property and you have to split income for federal as well. Just filing a joint return on the state is not going to solve the federal problem.
Got it. Karen, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Eric in Endeavor will go to you now. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Thanks for doing this. I got approved for disability recently after waiting for 4 years. So I got back pay for that, and then I have ongoing disability. Do I need to save for taxes for all that?
Where is your disability coming from? The employer, an insurance agency, the Social Security, or is it Medicaid?
Social Security.
Okay. Social Security, disability is treated just like regular Social Security. So if you have some other income, it may be taxable. If it's the only thing that you're living on, it probably won't be taxable. So it depends on your situation. But yes, you need to look into it and possibly have the taxation of it.
Yeah. Eric, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly now with your tax question. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And an email from Mary. Mary, she owns a second home that is being used as the residence of her daughter. Mary's daughter has paid the taxes, insurance, and utilities. And Mary herself receives no rental income from the property. How should Mary and her daughter report their taxes? Is there depreciation that should be reported on Mary's taxes? Can either of them use the property taxes as a deduction?
Okay. First of all, Mary's daughter does not own the home. So the property taxes are not deductible to someone generally who doesn't own the home. So from that perspective, no. The problem is, with the daughter paying things, it could be looked on as if Mary is renting the property to the daughter. If that's the case, Mary should be filing a Schedule C to take all of the payments that the daughter has made for things for the property as rental income. If she has rental income, then depreciation would be appropriate in that case. If it's not rental income, I mean, if it's just paying for some expenses and it's not really a rental agreement, then Mary is being kind to her daughter, and the daughter is kind of reciprocating. Mary would get the insurance payments, tax payments as a deduction on Mary's return. So it depends on what kind of situation. Again, in this, when you are really renting a property out, fair market rental is something to consider, not below market rental, because if it is a below market rental, then the rental is basically taxable and there's no deductions against it. So it's an involved situation. They have to decide what it is. Just on the surface, Mary's daughter living in Mary's property is considered Mary's second home there. The payments could complicate things a little bit.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Tim and Mellum, thank you for joining in. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I've been a taxpayer for 50 years now, and I didn't file in 2023, and I just got a letter from the IRS, and I've never owed taxes before, so I was just wondering, if the IRS owes you money, do you have to file taxes?
If the IRS owes you money, In other words, if you had filed, you would have had a refund. Do you have to file a tax return? Is that your question?
Yes, ma'am.
Filing depends on the dollar amounts that I mentioned to you earlier, the standard deduction depending on your age. If the income the IRS is through reports exceeds the filing requirement, they expect a tax return. Sometimes they don't bother people with the letter because they know that they would be paying you back. My suspect is that if you got the letter, they're not seeing the fact that they owe you money, and they're seeing that your income that's been reported to them exceeds the filing requirement, and therefore they're looking for a tax return.
So, Tim, looks like you may have to file a tax return for the 51st time. There you go. Thank you for calling. Josh in Eau Claire, we'll go to you now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning. Yeah, I just had a thought. I heard you talking about Mary and her daughter. I thought that a land contract between Mary and her daughter might simplify things quite a bit, both just on the legal side of it as well as the taxation side of it. Give her daughter an ownership interest in the property and define what each of the parties' responsibilities are.
Oh.
An interesting thought, but that assumes Mary wants to give up the property.
Yeah.
Or share the property, and that may not be the case.
Yeah, but it's something to think about if it was the case. Josh, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Willow in Madison, your turn. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. We own a property in Florida, and we're about to make out a will here in Madison. Would that will cover the property in Florida?
That I would say is a legal question. That in your will, from my non-legal side, in your will, you're telling about all the property you own. If there is anything special about the state, I would strongly suggest that you check it out with legal counsel.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you very much for calling. And Brian in Madison will go to you. Hi, Brian.
Hello. I own some national stocks. And when should the tax statements be mailed? I haven't seen them yet.
You own stock through the company itself or through a brokerage?
Through a brokerage.
The brokers generally have been mailing their composite statements out anywhere from the 15th of February on. There are some of them that arrive a little bit later. But one of the things that I would do, if you haven't gotten it, contact the broker and also make sure that you haven't signed up for online only. And, you know, maybe they're sitting out there online for you to download them. That seems to be a popular thing today. So check with your brokers. Most of the brokerage companies have at least sent an initial statement out or a note saying we expect it to be ready at such and such a date.
There you go, Brian. Thank you for calling. Elliot emailed his college-age son was away at college in another state for most of the year. Is he still considered a Wisconsin resident?
My answer to that question quickly is, generally, the answer is yes. The reason that a college student is considered a resident of the state, even though they attend college in another state, is because, in theory, this is the home in the current state, is their permanent residence where they intend to return during vacations, during summer break, etc. It gets a little dicier when the student maybe wants in-state tuition for where they're at, and maybe that they have somehow established a permanent residence there. But short of that intended issue, being temporarily away from home, which a student is considered temporarily away from home, they would continue to be a resident of Wisconsin.
Okay. Tom emailed us, how can you select a tax preparer and what questions should you ask the preparer and what services can you expect from the preparer?
That's a wonderful question, Tom. The first thing that I would look at is what kind of services are you looking for? If you're looking for the preparation of a tax return, and no other additional guidance with it, anyone that is holds themselves out as a preparer is reasonable. As preparers, we have to have what's called a PTIN number, which means that all preparers register with the state of register with the government. If you are getting a fly-by-night person that doesn't sign a tax return, checks the box self-prepared when they're doing your tax return, maybe doesn't have an office, then you should stay away from that person. But you might ask, what kind of credentials do you have? Preparers have anyone can be a preparer by having a PTIN number. There is another level of it, which is called annual filing season record of completion preparer. That means that they've taken a test and done some studying above and beyond what an unlicensed or person without any other credentials would have. And then you go to an enrolled agent, you go to a CPA, you go to a tax attorney. All of those people are available depending on what you want for services.
Mary Mellum, our guest today, a tax professional from Green Bay. Her business is Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Questions for her, you can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her with us. And lots of callers online, so I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Jack in Eau Claire. Hi, Jack.
Hey, good morning.
What's on
Thanks
your
for
mind?
Taking my call. I do my own taxes with online, or on the computer, and usually have no issues. This year, one of the questions that popped up on the H&R block was, have you had a theft this year? And over the summer of 2024, we had a theft by a contractor in the total of $62,500, and our contractor didn't do any work and demolished our whole kitchen. Anyway, I know we won't be able to write off and get that total amount back, but I'm wondering, and I've done some research, if it was an investment towards our property, if we're able to claim that as a loss or any kind of anything that we can do on our taxes.
If you had a contract with the person and they did not fulfill the contract, it is possible that it could be written off as a loss in that area. To be honest, with the casualty and theft losses, I personally always have to look up the specific rules because they are different in all situations. So I'm going to say do some looking. Casualty theft or casualty losses, which they all are on the same form, they start there. The casualty losses are much harder to do unless you're in a presidentially declared disaster area. Theft losses, like the Madoff issue and some of those things, have a little different set of rules. So I would suggest that you go to the casualty and theft publication that the IRS has and take a look at the theft side of it. That I know at some points, because you are have a contractor, that it's a breach of contract, and that may possibly be where you're allowed to take a loss.
All right. Jack, there you go. Thank you, and good luck. Ken in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I have a Social Security income. I'm retired. I'm in my 70s, and I have a Social Security income of a little over $9,000. But I have an unearned income from dividends in money market funds of $7,600. Do I have to do any filing at all?
If those are the only two things you have, the answer is no. Because the Social Security, up to half of the Social Security would be taxable if half of the Social Security plus your unearned income was more than, as a single person, $25,000. And that's not where you're going to be in that case.
All right. There you go, Ken. Thank you for calling. Jalen in Madison. On to you now. Hi, Jalen.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So my question is, I worked at a fast food job for a year, made pretty good money. They took out pretty good taxes. And everything looked okay until I got my W-2 back. And it says that they didn't take any federal out, and that wasn't what it was supposed to be. I don't know how to fix it, how to go about it. I called, like, tax places, and they said that it was a mess up on the food company, but they don't want to help. So how do I go about that?
Good question. When you got your check, did you get a statement with your check showing the deductions on it, or can you go online and pull that off?
Yeah, I can pull that up, and I believe I got them through paper slips.
Okay. And on those, when you look at that, your net check, had they taken a deduction for federal income tax or state income tax? Now, that's not Social Security or Medicare. If on those they had taken that out of your check, then the W-2 is incorrect. And if you have that proof that your W-2 doesn't match what your pay stubs say, there is a W-2, an alternate W-2 form that you could file with the government claiming what you say and showing the withholding. It's called a substitute W-2. And you need to have the backup, because there's some disconnect if you can see it on your statements that say they withheld that and then they didn't do it when it comes to the W-2, which, if that was the case, you're going to have the proof, because chances are the W-2 is what went into the government, and if they hadn't paid the taxes into the government's not going to see it. So you're going to have a fight on your hands, but probably the substitute W-2 form is the one that you're going to be looking for. And it's an 8,000 form number, which off the top of my head, I can't tell you what it is, but I will do a little looking and mention it when I get to it. But if you Google substitute W-2, you should find this IRS form. And again, if you have your records that show that they took it out of your check and it is federal or state withholding, I would certainly go from that angle.
Maybe 4852?
That may be the form. Let me see if I can come up with the form. I unfortunately call it a substitute W-2 and don't always remember the form number.
All right, Jalen, there you go. Thank you so much. And stay listening. Mary will check that out as we move along just to make sure it was a 48-52. Gary in Spring Valley. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Say, I filed my tax returns on TurboTax a couple months ago now, in February. And I pay estimated tax every quarter. And after I filed, about 3 weeks later, I got a notice of adjustment from the state of Wisconsin, saying that my withholding or my actual paid-in taxes didn't agree with what I said on the return. And in checking out what happened here, is I inadvertently put my last federal tax check in the state form and sent the state my federal estimated tax, which was way more than the state, so I was going to get a refund from the state. I originally owed tax to both state and federal, and I was going to have it taken out of my bank account on April 4th. So now I know I've got this shortfall at the IRS, and I don't know if I should file an amended return or should I just wait for them to send me an adjustment of my tax paid.
Let me clarify what I heard you say. What I heard you say is the last estimated tax check went to the state rather than to the federal. Is that correct?
Yes, and the state one went to the federal. So I'm more underpaid at the federal than I originally filed my return.
What the best thing to do, because you're going to get a notice when the dust falls out, the IRS is going to send you a bill because what you say you owe is not or have coming back is not right. They will do that. It's a question of how long it'll take them to do that. And if you owe them and it gets past April 15th, you'll owe them interest and penalty. So you could do an amended return. It could get caught up in how fast the processing goes. So I guess it depends on how large the number is and how much it might cost you. But if you tell the IRS that you've sent them money and they didn't receive it, you're going to get an adjustment letter back saying that you owe them more money. And you'll have to pay it either as soon as that comes, or you know, doing an amended return would be one way to correct it and send in the extra money. It's still, either way, it's going to take a little while to wash out because the amended returns are going to take longer to process. So I guess it just depends on your patience, but probably you should do something before April 15th or you have the potential of a penalty.
Yep, that makes good sense. Gary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Just a quick mention, after 12:30, we'll be talking about the UW and Marquette men's basketball team's prospects as they head into the NCAA tournament. And tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about State Park. So lots going on there. On this particular show, we've got Mary Mellum answering your tax questions, and she'll be with us till 12:30. And again, join in. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mehler here as we talk taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. been in the business more than 30 years to serve individuals, consult other tax professionals, and teach seminars around the country, Mary and her husband, David. Great to have her back. She always does such a wonderful job. An email came in, Mary, there. Valerie emailed a retired civil service employee who was affected by the Social Security Fairness Act. Valerie received a deposit over $7,000 this week for the unpaid Social Security income that was owed to Valerie for 2024. Valerie has not had federal income tax withheld from Social Security since it was previously such a small amount. She's already filed and received a refund on 2024 taxes. Will there be a penalty for all those who are now receiving in 2025 a year's worth of back pay owed due to the passage of the Social Security Act on 2025 taxes?
My answer to that is possibly. It depends on that particular person's tax situation. I'm assuming she received this money in 2025, not in 2024.
Correct.
So it will affect her 25 return. Worst case scenario, her Social Security statement is going to include the normal Social Security she received plus this extra payment. And under general rules, whatever you received goes into the Social Security determination, taxability determination formula. And with her other income, if it is potentially up to 85% taxable, she may well or they may well be subject to penalties. However, when it's back Social Security, it's usually indicated on that, and there is a special election or a special opportunity to go back to the year that that payment was for, take that amount. It's called lump sum Social Security election, and you can go back to that year, put it into that year, not amend that year, but put it into that year to see how much of it would have been taxable in that year. And if it is less than what would be taxable in the current year, you can use the lower figure for that year. Again, there's IRS formulas and election or worksheets and things out there. But that would be one way to reduce the problem potentially.
Yeah. Judy in Green Bay may have a similar question. Judy, hi.
Hi. Yes, I do have a similar question. I was affected by the act as well, but I pay estimated quarterly taxes, and we're not getting any indication of how much extra our monthly Social Security is going to be, potentially till after April 15th. And so it's hard for me to estimate accurately what my quarterly payment should be. Can I readjust upwards for the June payment, the September payment, in the fourth quarter?
You can certainly do that. Worst case scenario, the IRS looks at everything or wants everything paid evenly. And so if there is an underpayment, and the IRS generally isn't going to bother you too much, but they look at it on a quarterly basis. So if you end up with an underpayment and the underpayment penalty comes up, it would only be for that one quarter that you didn't raise it potentially. And you can always, there is a form that you can, it's an annual exception form. And if the penalty is really high, you might want to do the annual exception formula and it would not give you a penalty for the whole year. Again, it's a more involved thing. I think if you raise what if you have any idea how much it's going to be, if you raise your withholding, your quarterly payments for the third quarter, or if you haven't sent the one in for this quarter, raise them all. Worst case scenario, you're going to get the money back if you've overextended yourself, but that's more of a protection side. Your first quarterly payment, if you haven't made it yet, is due April 15th. And so I guess on a protection side, I would probably think about raising them all. And also, if you cover last year's taxes with your estimated tax payments, you can put off having to pay the penalty. So making your tax estimates 100% of last year's taxes, or if you make over $150,000, 110% of last year's will get you out of a penalty. So that's another way around it.
Judy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jim and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
A question. My wife had a very modest inheritance. Her mom died in 23, and in 24, I got some 1099s on a variable annuity, and a small amount, like about 12 grand. And then there was a sale of a house, and a 1099 was produced off of that. And I don't know, I Googled it, and according to Wisconsin, there's no death tax or inheritance tax. And if it's federal, it's supposed to be over a mil. And this is, you know, there were six kids, and I think she ended up with maybe 50,000 or something. Anyway, I'm stymied as what these 1099s, if I'm really going to have to pay some tax on them or not.
Jim, that's a good question, and part of it to begin with is there is a difference between inheritance tax and income tax. The large amount or the fact that Wisconsin has no inheritance tax is not an income tax issue. That is tied to the federal estate tax, we call it, and that has the $13 million dollar amount. And that has to do with the value of all your assets when you die. That is not what your issue is. When people inherit money, if they inherit what we call income in respect of a decedent, something the decedent would have had to pay taxes on had they been alive, that's going to be taxable to the person who inherits it. And your 1099R from the variable annuity is telling me that's what you have and that will be taxable. On the other hand, the sale of the residence, that could be a taxable event. Certainly it's a reportable event. The difference with the sale of residence, if you inherit a residence, at the time of death, the property is revalued at the date of death value. So when it's later sold, the sale price is compared to that new value. And in many cases, there is no gain to pay taxes on because of that revalued or adjusted cost basis that the people have. But if you've got the documents, you have to report them or the IRS is going to send letters because they see documents under your Social Security number and say, your return doesn't include that. We want an explanation.
There you go, Jim. Thank you for calling. Mary in Hollandale, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, thanks for the great show. I have a question about whether there's a time limit to claim a loss on an investment that was purchased through a brokerage. Like, it was more than 10 years ago. And the broker just said, huh, I'll have to look into that, and I never did anything about it.
So is there a time limit to claim a loss from an investment, Mary?
Yes, there is. I believe that you can go back 6 years. Generally, you're not going to get a refund on something that happened more than 3 years ago. I mean, that's the general rule, because that's how long the federal return is open. The state is open 4 years. There is an exception, I believe it's 6 years, that because of certain losses, you can go back for, I believe it's 6 years. Again, you need to check into it, but 10 years is too far back. What you do is, if it's a stock loss, it's touchy area again, because when did this, if like a worthless stock, when did the stock become worthless? It may be that they filed bankruptcy, but the worthlessness wasn't determined until a certain year. Or if it's a lawsuit, it might be when it's found, you know, when it's totally over. So find out that date before you start looking back. I believe the number for worthless stock or that kind of thing is a 6 year, maybe a 7 year, but that would be the limitation, certainly not the 10 years.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Gerald in Rhinelander next. Hi, Gerald.
Hi. My question has to do with getting information from the IRS about how much I have paid in estimated taxes. I went online, and it only shows the first two payments for the year. And I called up and found someone who looked into the system and said that they showed the other two payments. Why doesn't it show on the online transcript or whatever that you...
Yeah,
it seems like they must have two systems that the agents can get more information than the taxpayer can.
That's an interesting question. I'm assuming if you got to see something at the IRS, you went into the account transcript under your name, because the IRS does not have a nice, neat place to look up estimated tax payments. The state, on the other hand, has a very nice tool that is called an estimated tax lookup, where with the proper identification or proper information, you can go up and go into the state of Wisconsin and see exactly when those payments were made. But the federal doesn't. So I don't have an answer for you to say why it shows up in one system and not in the other. What I would go is to look into, did your checks clear? Do you have a record of what you paid? And I would start with the bank or however it is that you make those payments to the IRS.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Gerald, thank you for calling. Roddy emailed, he used to claim itemized deductions, but for the past couple of years, his tax professional has recommended taking the standard deduction. Has anything changed with the requirements for claiming itemized deductions? When does it make sense to claim itemized deductions?
Again, another good question. The 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act increased the standard deduction. For a married couple, the standard deduction is about $29,000. Nothing has changed in the ability to claim a standard deduction versus or claim itemized deductions. There were some itemized deductions that were eliminated under the Jobs Cut, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. And with the higher standard deduction, it makes it more difficult to get over that level and benefit from it. Usually the people we see itemizing deductions are people that have high medical costs. For retired people that may be in nursing homes or qualified assisted living places, they can have very high medical costs that cause them to itemize. Another area that causes people to itemize are high charitable contributions. And in today's market of having very expensive homes and high mortgage interest rates, if you have one of those mortgages that has a high mortgage interest payments, that could be your other area. So the medical, the mortgage interest, the charity are those reasons where people may get over the standard deduction. Now, one thing that I do want to caution you on, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act sunsets at the end of 2025. If that act is allowed to expire, our standard deductions would go back to the 2017 level, which is about half of what it is currently. If that were to happen, itemized deductions would become popular again. So we'll wait to see what Congress does about that.
Jackie emailed us. Jackie owns a condo with four other couples that earns rental income. Every year, the condo management sends the wrong information on the 1099. One year, they put all rental income in Jackie's name. If they don't get the correct 1099 to me by tax day, can Jackie still file taxes if Jackie knows the correct amount?
Yes. It would be Jackie should use the correct amount. What she might want to do, whomever it is, if it's in the wrong person's name, there's something called a nominee 1099 that could be sent. If Jackie had it all in her name and it didn't all belong to her, she could send a nominee 1099 to the other people that are involved. That would tell the IRS, yes, I got this 1099 and I'm giving away the part that belongs to the other people, and the net effect would only be her share of it.
Okay. Carl called, couldn't stay with us. 74 years old, works part time and putting into a 104K. He hasn't received any RMD. If you haven't received any 104K, are you required to take an RMD?
Okay, I think what he's talking about is a 401K.
Oh. Yes, it's got to be a 401K.
Yes, and there is a rule that if the 401K that he is, the job he is working at and putting money into the 401K, he does not have to take it out of that plan until he leaves that employment, if he has exceeded the RMD rules. So if Carl continues to work for the company that is the 401k in question, he could work till he's 80 and not have to take money out of that plan until he leaves his employment. However, if Carl has any other 401ks or IRAs not related to that, he has to abide by the RMD requirements for those other plans because he is age 73 or over, which is the current RMD age.
Jeff emailed us with something more for the caller with the W-2 problem, Jalen. You didn't answer part of the question. If Fed taxes really were withheld, you didn't answer what he should do if they weren't withheld. Jeff thinks he needs to either make an estimated payment immediately or make sure to make a federal payment when he files, plus any penalties or interest for paying late, now versus during the year.
Well, I think that's good advice, but the topic we were talking about at the time, which I want to mention, you were exactly right, 4852 is the substitute W-2 form. And part of it is getting to the bottom of the problem. Were there, what happened to that situation? I think the rest of the problem as far as if you didn't have taxes withheld and you think you did, obviously you're going to have to pay the taxes. But I think sorting out the problem and maybe the employer being penalized if they told you they withheld taxes and really didn't send it in is a whole nother part of that.
Oh, yes. So you want to make sure that that gets corrected for sure. Wow. Well, Mary, it's been a pleasure, as always, talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope you can do this again with us.
Well, I would love to do it again with you.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks very much for joining us. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, who's been in the tax business for more than 30 years. And coming up next, we'll talk about the UW men's and the Marquette men's basketball team's prospects as they head into the NC2A tournament. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Ah, it's March. March Madness is upon us. The Badgers are 26-9 so far this season, and they've earned the number 3 seed in the NCAA tournament's East region. On the other hand, Marquette is 23-10 overall, and they're the number 7 seed in the South region. So what can we expect from these teams in the tournament this year? Larry Mueller here again for WPR News. Talking college hoops with a couple of experts today. One of them, Ben Wargel, senior writer at BadgerBlitz.com. And he's been covering Wisconsin football, basketball, and recruiting since 2004. Ben Wargel, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And with us as well, Ben Steele. He covers the Marquette Golden Eagles men's basketball team and other sports topics. For the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ben Steele, welcome to you. Thanks for joining in.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Excited to share the airwaves with you, two fine gentlemen.
Okay. Well, as you listen to these guys, I hope you'll join in. You may be planning to watch the NCAA tournaments, want to know which teams you're cheering for. Have you filled out your brackets yet? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, I'm going to ask you guys kind of the same question to begin with. Ben Wargel, start with you. You've covered dozens of March Madnesses. What do you love about this time of year, and what do you dread?
I love about this time of year is that there is the desperation of every game where, you know, if you have a bad game, you're done. And it really can define your season, especially when it comes to, I think, Wisconsin in recent years. Wisconsin's had some great teams under Greg Gard, and they've gone into the NCAA tournament with some great teams and have had bad shooting stretches. They've had an injury here or there, and suddenly in 140 minutes, your season is done. And I think that's where the dread comes in, too, because, you know, you look at these teams that look, hey, this team could go really far, and you run into a hot shooting mid-major team with a lot of experience. You run into an injury, and all of a sudden it's just over like that. And the job you've been doing since, you know, mid-September, all of a sudden you're in the off-season mode very quickly. And I think that's what makes this tournament so exciting is the unpredictability of it. I mean, the odds of a perfect bracket are like one in a gazillion or something like that. It never happens. And I think that's what makes it fun is this, the unexpectedness of the tournament and the ability of a team no one expected, like Florida Gulf Coast a couple of years ago, wins a couple of games, gets the Sweet 16, Purdue losing in the first round as a one seed, Virginia losing in the first round as a one seed. That's what makes the tournament fun.
Yeah. Ben Steele, what about you? How long you've been writing about March Madness for a bit of time. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it's the unpredictability. Me and Ben can throw a bunch of stats at you about Montana and who Wisconsin is playing, and Marquette's going to play New Mexico, and I can watch a bunch of film on both teams, but that all goes out the window. Whatever we say to you today, probably the exact opposite is going to happen when these teams play tomorrow or later this week. And you know, with that unpredictability comes that finite end of the season, and just the dread. You asked about the dread covering these teams, man. Just the pain that you see on the pain of the players and the coaches in the locker room after that sudden end of the season. That's always like a little heartbreaking to see. And as a journalist, you have to go in there and ask questions anyway. But we're human beings too. So just seeing that pain on the players and coaches' faces, that's the dark side of March.
Yeah. Well, as long as you're still with us, what did you think of Marquette's year this year? I mean, they started like a house of fire.
They were trending toward a 2 seed, which they've been the last couple of years. And since February 1st, they kind of hit a little rough stretch for the last month and a half of the season, regular season. There's a lot of reasons for that. Marquette's a team that doesn't rely on the transfer portal like other teams. So I think at the beginning of the season, they have that continuity advantage where other teams are trying to figure themselves out a little bit. Marquette's already there. And then other teams kind of catch up with them right at the end of the regular season once they've had time to gel. Marquette's often gotten banged up. Several players are just nursing nagging injuries. Now that's pretty much every team this time of year. And the other side of the Marquette and I using the transfer portal is all their bench guys are younger, developing players, whereas other teams, you know, will bring in like a 22, 23-year-old just to help out off the bench. Marquette guys are younger, and I think that sometimes when they face other teams that have that age advantage, that's where Marquette can struggle a little bit.
Yeah. And Ben Wergel, what about Wisconsin's year this year? And Ben Steele was mentioning pulling some players in. You know, at the start of the year, you wondered if Wisconsin was going to do anything after losing two premier players.
Yeah, they actually lost 7 players to the portal and a starter in Tyler Walls. I mean, you had to replace 3 starters from your lineup. And you go into the portal and you pick up a guy from Central Arkansas named Cameron Hunter. And you thought, okay, this is going to be a point guard that Wisconsin is going to utilize to help replace Chucky Hepburn. Well, that hasn't materialized this year. Then you pick up a guy named Xavier Amos from Northern Illinois, who's going to be a junior. And he's done some good things, but it's kind of struggled to adjust a little bit to the Big Ten level. And then this third guy from Colorado State and Missouri named John Tonji, who only played, 6-ish games last year, had a knee injury. Well, he's an older guy. He played 4 years at Colorado State. You know, maybe he can kind of help replace what Wisconsin's losing with A.J. Storr. And that's part of the reason why Wisconsin was picked to finish a tie for 12th in the league. And, you know, no one could have predicted what John Tonji has been able to do for this team and how he's elevated all the players around him. I mean, you know, Wisconsin didn't play the toughest non-conference schedule as they've had in the past, but, you know, in the fourth game, they have a return game against Arizona, who's ranked 9th in the country, and Tonji drops like 41 points on the Wildcats. And you go, oh, my goodness, you know, can this be sustained? And then, you know, about a week and a half later, he drops 30-plus against Pittsburgh to win a November holiday tournament. You go, okay, you know, maybe this offense and John Tonji can be a real, you know, potent thing, and that's been the case all season long. I mean, Wisconsin has been averaging the most points they've had since the 71-72 season. They've scored over 17 times this year. I mean, there were years where Wisconsin was winning games in the 40s, and now it's consistently with this team putting up 70-plus, 80-plus, and Tonji's been a big part of that. You know, he was held scoreless against USC on January 18th, and ever since then, he has scored the most points in the nation. He's averaging 21.4 since January 21st. He's got 5 games over 30, and he really carried them to that Big Ten title game where he simply just ran out of gas. So Wisconsin has used the portal selectively. They don't just go for any old player. They go for the right fit. And Wisconsin knew they were having a much older locker room this year with guys like Stephen Kral and Max Klesmant and Carter Gilmore and Kamari McGee, guys that have been around for several years. To add a veteran six-year guy into that locker room who's very humble, very workmanlike, doesn't have all the answers, it's just been a perfect marriage between John Tonje and Wisconsin. It's part of the reason why that they're sitting where they're sitting going into Thursday's NCAA tournament opener.
I would think, you know, just the opener, it's as I'm looking at the clock right now, and it's I believe the Badgers are just getting into the air to fly to out to Colorado. And I did want to mention, I was really disappointed in the seedings, and I think some other people were too, of having to play, not getting Milwaukee for one thing for the tournament, but then having to play, to go to Colorado and play on Thursday. I mean, they didn't get back to Madison until midnight on Sunday, and then they're leaving today for Colorado. It just didn't seem fair.
Yeah, and you have to deal with the altitude, too, of Denver.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing, too. And Tonje, who played 4 years at Colorado State, kind of talked about that and, you know, the adjustment period that, you know, it's going to take. But, you know, they're going to get there today. They're going to go through a practice tomorrow. And so, I mean, there'll be time to adjust. Other teams have to adjust to it, too. But, you know, Montana, I don't think, has as much of an adjustment to the altitude. Michigan's the same way. Michigan is coming out to Colorado, too, on the other side of the bracket. You know, you look at Wisconsin's profile, you know, 8 quadrant one wins, 18 wins in quadrant one and two, no losses outside quadrant two. You know, you get to the Big Ten tournament title game. You would think that'd be enough to get to Milwaukee, but the problem is, you know, there's, what, 14 teams from the SEC in. The committee talked about they didn't want to put more than 4 schools from any one conference in, and that kind of caused them to kind of, you know, bounce around teams. No one lost a seed, according to the committee, but you had to kind of move regions around. You know, on the seed list, Kentucky and Iowa State were the two teams directly above Wisconsin. Iowa State put together a really good year. They were 16-9 in the top two quadrants. You know, they're the closest region or the closest pod to Iowa State is Milwaukee, since Wichita was out with Texas Tech and Houston. Kentucky can't play in Lexington because they're the host city. And you look up at Cleveland, that's the near site to them too. And Michigan State's going there. I forget what other school's going there. And so they're going to Milwaukee. And so just kind of the way it bounced, I know a lot of people were disappointed. But, you know, frankly, if Wisconsin beats Penn State and or Oregon down the stretch, you know, we're not having that topic of conversation. And I will say, too, Greg Gard has talked for many, many years, is that he's spoken to the league about this, that the teams that play Sunday in the Big Ten title game should at least have a Friday site, just for that extra rest, that for the travel, for all those things. It's kind of like yelling into the wind a little bit because it hasn't changed in all those years. But, you know, it's not an excuse. They were happy for the 3 seed. They're happy for the pod. And I think it's actually a pretty good pod for Wisconsin, too. And so just maybe with how they play on Sunday, maybe a quick turnaround for them, getting a chance to play again on Thursday is the right thing for them.
Ben Steele, what about Marquette? Are they more or less happy with where they are and their seating and so forth?
Yeah, I guess all things considered, you know, with their late season struggles, Marquette was kind of trending toward an 8, not quite a 9, but an 8 seed, you know, that's a tough draw. You know, if you've managed to get by an 8-9 game, which is a, you know, generally a coin flip game, without that outcome, like, then you'd have to face the top seeded team in the next round. So getting up to a 7 seed for Marquette was probably the best thing for them. They face a New Mexico team that, quite frankly, I didn't know much about, but I don't think Marquette coaches, they're diving into the film these last couple of days. It's an interesting matchup for them. if they get past New Mexico State, then they'll play Michigan State, that Ben mentioned them going to be in Cleveland. That's going to be an interesting game because the Marquette and Michigan State met 2 years ago, also in Ohio, in Columbus. So it could be an interesting matchup should both teams advance from there. It's kind of a bad matchup. Michigan State would be a bad matchup for Marquette. Marquette kind of struggles against bigger teams with bigger front lines, wide-bodied. Ben knows this. He's seen Michigan State a bunch of times, of defense and hardcore rebounding teams of Tom Izzo. Those are the kind of teams that give Marquette trouble. So if Marquette manages to get by the first round, that's going to be a tough matchup for them in the second round if Michigan State advances too.
Yeah. And Wisconsin, Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Montana hasn't played a ton of high-level competition. That's kind of what you expect from the Big Sky Conference. Wisconsin played Montana State earlier in the year. I mean, not really much you can kind of glean from that. I think that was the second or third game of the year. Montana's a little bit shorter. They don't have anyone taller than 6'8", so one would think that Stephen Crowell and Noel Winter can be aggressive early. I think Montana is like the 18th worst offensive rebounding rate in the country. They're proficient with their field goal percentage, though. They have the 13th highest effective field goal percentage in the country, about 56.4%. They have a bunch of guards that can shoot it well from distance. I think they have four players who shoot over 35% from three. Just looking up here real quick. Grizzlies, they lost to Oregon in the second game of the year by 31. They lost to Tennessee by 35. So two NCAA tournament teams. Wisconsin obviously played Oregon a couple weeks ago and lost in overtime. So there's a little bit of comparison there. But one would think that this is a game that Wisconsin should be able to win. And then you look into the next round against BYU from the Big 12. They've been known to shoot it exceptionally well. They've had some good wins on their resume. And then, you know, VCU wins the regular season and the tournament Atlantic 10 championship. So those will be two interesting. If Wisconsin advances, either one will be a very interesting and a tough matchup for them as well.
Yeah. Talking with Ben Wargle, the senior writer at BadgerBlitz.com. He's been covering Wisconsin football, basketball, and recruiting for 21 years. Ben Steele covers Marquette Golden Eagles men's basketball team and other sports topics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Questions, comments, gripes or not, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Talking with Ben Wargle and Ben Steele. Ben Wargle writes for Badger Blitz. Ben Steele writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Great to have them with us as we talk the NCAA tournament. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Ben Wargle, back to you for a minute. I'm wondering, and Ben Steele, I'll be asking you this question as well. Who surprised you off the bench this year? I thought we got some pretty good bench help that I was somewhat surprised at in a couple instances.
Yeah, I thought we'd see more Kamari McGee this year, the reserve point guard from Racine, especially with Chucky Hepburn departing and leaving him on the bench in favor of John Blackwell starting, I think was the right move. The amount of energy that McGee has brought to the table this season, I think has really kind of benefited this team, a little bit of change of pace. I think Jack Janicki, you saw him during fall camp, and this was a kid that really could shoot the ball well, very hard nose, very aggressive defensively. And so his performance this year didn't surprise me. Carter Gilmore with his offense has got to be one of the biggest surprises of the year for this team. I mean, he went 120 career games without scoring in double figures, and then he drops 12 or 14 against Northwestern. I think it was 14, I'm forgetting. And then the next game, he gets MVP chance and as he gets in double figures again. And, you know, he's always been underappreciated, and I think a large segment of the fan, small vocal segment of the fan base have really disliked his usage over the years. But he's an eraser for Wisconsin. He erases mistakes. He's very smart defensively. He can play a number of different positions. Wisconsin's used him at the five at times this year to be a little bit more mobile. The block that he had on Trey Holloman, the amount of distance that he had to cover in the Big Ten semifinals was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And just his confidence, he's grown with his confidence this season, and that's allowed him to shoot the ball more. And I think Wisconsin wanting to encourage guys to shoot from the perimeter more when they're open, not pass up open looks, and the amount of work that he put in the gym in the off season has really kind of helped lift his game this season. He's shooting 35% from three after going a combined 9 for 55 in his first 4 years at Wisconsin. So that's probably one of the feel-good stories of this team this year is what Gilmore has brought off the bench and how the narrative of the fan base has changed from more with disdain when he comes in to a really profound appreciation for the work that he's done this year for this team.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Ben Steele, the Marquette bench, probably, well, it's a young bench, but you got a lot of promising people there, have you not?
Marquette really relies on its starters. And like I mentioned earlier, it's all freshmen and sophomores coming off the bench for the Golden Eagles. So that in and of itself means that there's going to be up and down performances from these young players. But a couple of guys have stood out to me. A guy like Zade Lowry, who's a sophomore, didn't play much last season, was expected to take a bigger role this season, and he's been up and down. He had a career high, like 25 points against Villanova just about a month ago. It looked like he was going to take off from there, but then he takes a step back, and I don't think he's had 25 combined points in the games since then. But the talent is there when you see it, just the way he moves and the way he can guard different positions. He's a kind of, you know, he's like a 6'5", fluid athlete, those kind of switchable guys that Shaka Smart likes to play. Who can guard you full court. Another guy who I wasn't expecting much as a freshman, but has impressed me and several times this season is Royce Parham. Marquette doesn't have a lot of front court depth. Royce Parham's usually the first big guy off the bench. I was particularly impressed with him last week in the Big East tournament. You know, sometimes under the hot lights at Madison Square Garden, you know, in a full house. This was Royce's first postseason game in college, so it was impressive to me that he came out there and had 10 points. The most impressive thing about Royce Parham is he's not afraid of the moment. He's not shy about putting up shots. I think he put up 4 threes in that game in about 10, 15 minutes. He gives Marquette a little more fluid, a little more shooting from the big guy spot. So those are a couple names off the bench for Marquette. But Marquette really does rely on its starters quite a bit.
Yeah. Jim and Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Just a question for Ben about Wisconsin's offensive scheme and its change or metamorphosis over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the big storyline this year. It really kind of began two postseasons ago when Wisconsin missed the tournament and went to the NIT and had a really good run and until they went to the semifinals and played North Texas, and then they didn't score for like the final 9-plus minutes of the game. And I think it became abundantly clear to Greg Garden and his staff that they needed to evolve. And it really kind of came to a head last two Novembers ago when they got really beaten badly at Providence, for those that remember that game in the Big Ten, Big East Challenge. They got stuck in Providence for an extra long period of time because of weather issues, and the coaching staff kind of sat around and discussed about what they needed to do, and they decided to go all in to making this change. And, you know, the addition of Kirk Penny, who had recently retired as a special assistant to the head coach, he's really had his fingerprints involved with all of this because of the amount of international play that Kirk has done all over the world. He's playing all these different offenses and really just more of a ball screen, spread the floor type scheme. And they felt that was something they could really, you know, take advantage of with how the rules have changed. It's gone to more of an offensive game and a defensive game. You know, Wisconsin's not going to have a guy like Brad Davidson drawing seven charges in a game anymore. It's just that's just not how the game is called and officiated. So Wisconsin kind of made that move last year, and they really benefit from it at some points. Other stretches they didn't. They didn't have all the personnel they needed to really run it. And this year they moved some pieces around with John Blackwell in the starting lineup, the addition of John Tonjay, the development of guys in the system, and it just really has taken off. I mean, it's one thing to score a lot of points, but it's one thing to be very efficient with your offense. And Wisconsin is the 13th most efficient offense in the country with their adjusted offensive efficiency. And that's really been the catalyst for this team. The defense has also helped. The defense has massively improved from where it was when they played Marquette in December, when they got beat badly defensively against UCLA in January. It'll be interesting to see if they can sustain this going forward, because you're losing a lot of pieces. You're going to have to go into the portal again. Can Wisconsin find the right pieces to make this offense that they have now established as their brand of basketball? Can they make that work next year with an entirely new cast of characters?
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. In the meantime, I've noticed, just going around on the social media and so forth, a lot of the prognosticators are picking Wisconsin as a dark horse. They're typically listed in the top 10 teams that might win or that stood a chance to win the tournament. I'll ask you both, who do you think's going to win the tournament this year? Is there any idea, Ben Wargle?
Well, whenever I fill out my bracket, I always know that I'm going to get most of it wrong. It's one of those things where a little bit of information that we know as sports writers tends to be the death of us all when we do a bracket. But the one thing I do know is that 88% of Final Four teams are in the top 50 in both adjusted offense and adjusted defense. And that's according to a site called KenPom.com. And so I look at teams that can score well and can defend well. Teams like Auburn, Iowa State, Duke, Alabama, Houston, Wisconsin is on that list. They're 13th in offense and I think 27th on defense. I think Florida is the most complete team in the country. They're first in offense, 10th in defense. So when I fill out my bracket, I'm probably going to lean using those analytics of the team that can really score well and defend well. I think Wisconsin has a chance to get to a Sweet 16. I think they have a good chance to get to a Sweet 16. It would be the first time since, I think, 2017. It's been a long stretch. I'll be interested to see what they can do after that, because I think for a lot of fans, get to the Sweet 16, you're kind of playing with house money at that point, and you just need two really good games, and you're in the Final Four. So that's what makes this tournament fun, just the unpredictability of it.
And we got about in the 30 seconds, Ben Steele, what do you think about how the tournament's going to turn out?
Wow, 30 seconds. Can I get in my predictions for every game of the tournament in that stretch? No, like Ben said, look at the offense. Look at teams with really good offenses, really good defenses. I would keep your eye on any team from the SEC. That's probably the best conference in the history of college basketball this season. They got 14 teams in the field this year, and Florida, I think, is the best one out of all of them. Just the way they offensive rebound, they can play any type of style, fast, slow. They can
really do everything. Well, here we are out of time. I agree with you guys on Florida for sure, and that's probably going to be in the big center of my bracket, Florida. Thank you very much, Ben Wargle, writer for BadgerBlitz.com. Ben Steele writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Great to have them with us. And thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.